guys know, is a very good leaving group. You're generally going to see the rest of them as florins because they're so electronegative and stable, resistant to metabolism and cleavage. Oftentimes can be given to little babies to get them under. There's not a lot of nausea and vomiting associated with this one, and it also causes less hypotension than a lot of your other generals that we're going to talk about. What I want you to pay attention to is, particularly, is the degree of metabolism you see with this one and the type of toxicity that you get with it. 20 to 25% of the dose is still very, very high when you think of metabolism. Methoxyfluorine was 70%, which was unacceptable, but still, if you compare halothane at this point on relative to the methoxyfluorine, you're like, it's a heck of a lot better than 70%. And it was used for a very long time. It's still used today. It's just used much less. Only in a selective population of people. Because at that time, you're like 20-25%. That's still much, much better than what we had available. But today, we have agents that are even way, it puts halothane to shame. But because of the metabolism, you're going to see some hepatotoxicity. Now, this brings the type of toxicity you see is directly related to metabolism. So you should review how these things are metabolized, and we'll get to it in a little bit. But did Dr. Cole talk to you at all about the acetic acid derivatives or the fluoride ions that are generated through metabolism? A little bit? No? Okay. Oftentimes we're going to find a lot of these agents will form trifluoroacetic acid. It doesn't even have to be trifluoroacetic acid. It could be any, quote, acetic, difluoroacetic acid or whatever. If it's an acetic acid metabolite or derivative, it is associated with hepatotoxicity, okay? Why do I need to know that? Well, because if you have 20 to 25% of a dose being metabolized and it's producing a metabolite that causes hepatotoxicity, if you have somebody that's hepatically compromised, might that be an issue? Absolutely. And you already know 20 to 25% of the dose would be metabolized, so you would produce a significant portion of that metabolite. So you got to think about that. If you produce fluoride ions, so through the general mechanisms, this is simple. A lot of it's dehydrohalogenation. A lot of it's just simple decomposition that we've talked about with metabolism that happens. But if you produce fluoride ions, then it's going to be more nephrotoxic. Okay. So when you look at an anesthetic, you should be able to, A, know the degree of metabolism. It's going to directly depend on which types of patient population you would give it to and what type of toxicity that it's going to be involved in. And so you might have to decompose an anesthetic and show me what metabolite would be produced and what toxicity would result because of it. But this one is pretty stable, and you are going to see a little bit of dehydrohalogenation happening with this one. So when we talk about the metabolism, this is primarily what's the mechanism of what's going on. Remember, we covered dehydrohalogenation with metabolism last semester. It was last semester, wasn't it? That we covered. You guys had drug action last semester, right?
Yeah.
So we covered it last semester. So remember what we're looking for with a molecule. When the P450 enzymes act, and which P450 enzymes are we talking about? Phase 1 or phase 2? Phase 1, right? So you're going to get hydroxylation at this hydrogen here. And then why am I showing the bromine leaving? For the chlorine leave?
Bromine is better leaving versus chlorine?
Right. Chlorine could potentially leave, but bromine is going to preferentially leave because it's a better leaving group. So that's why the alcohol is more, it's a little unstable, so it flushes. So these electrons come down, the bromine leaves, and you form this kind of intermediate molecule here that's very prone to nucleophilic attack. So water can come in right here, attack here, and then the chlorine leaves to produce your trifluoroacetic acid. Now halothane overall is a relatively stable molecule, but we already know it's prone to spontaneous oxidative decomposition via dehydrohalogenation. So what the companies sometimes do is they package this in a dark amber container and they put some preservatives in there to try and prevent the degradation of, you know, this, or slow the process of this breakdown happening. Now some patients, though, very sensitive and could possibly be allergic to some of the preservatives that are in it. Depends on what preservatives are going to be used and added to the product. So it's also a good idea sometimes to make sure that your patient is not allergic to any of the inactive ingredients or preservatives. There's lots of things you can read about it. We've talked about a lot of the things. Hypotension is common. Well, hypotension can be common with a lot of your anesthetics. Relative to the newer anesthetics, hypotension is going to be more withheld with some of the newer anesthetics, but it's still going to be much less than what we saw with earlier anesthetics that we had up to this point. All right. The next one is enflurane. So this is a direct descendant of an ether derivative. And so if you look at the structure, we talked about how metabolism, the hydrogen's adjacent to the ether, more prone to metabolism, right? So they fluorinated these hydrogens pretty much, and it decreased the degree of metabolism to this. Enflurane, however, though, is no longer used in the United States because of hepatotoxic effects. So we're not going to talk so much about it. The reason I mention it is because we have learned a lot from enflurane, and we have a direct descendant of enflurane that we still use to this day. And so although enflurane isn't used anymore, we still learned a lot about it and learned some of the properties that we want and don't want so that when we develop the next one, we have a much better drug. Now, relative to halothane, you only see 5% metabolized here, so they're getting much better. And usually, when you look at the structure, they're looking at making these structures way more stable and being resistant to metabolism so that you can decrease this toxicity. So they were successful here. The problem is that 5% that was metabolized is metabolized so severely into active metabolites that are hepatotoxic that it was just unreasonable. All right. Oh, I forgot I put this one in there. Kids and anesthetics. We're not going to have time to watch this little clip, but kids are going to be much more prone to toxic effects. You've got to be really careful which ones you're going to give to them because why? Which we alluded to this fact when we were talking about drug metabolism, but it's testing your knowledge, if you remember. Why are we more concerned about kids? Because why? Right, their liver enzymes could not be fully expressed, right? Remember when we talked about Tylenol last semester and how we talked about the primary mechanism for how Tylenol is cleared from the body? And we talked about your conjugation reactants. Remember glucuronyl transferase, right? And glucuronide conjugation. And how they're oftentimes deficient in that enzyme until it's fully developed, and that's the primary route of elimination. So they're going to be very prone to overdose. Anesthetics, they're also going to be prone to toxicity, so you're going to want to be really, really cautious and careful which ones you use in that case. All right, isoflurane, going back to, remember when we talked about M-fluorine just a second ago and I said it's no longer used? Well, this is a direct descendant of M-fluorine. So we have isoflurane, and this came out in the early 80s. It's very potent. We developed it keeping M-fluorine in mind. It can be used with epinephrine without great concerns of arrhythmias. This is good because you can decrease the dose if you do this. It does have an odor, a very characteristic odor that seems to cause a lot of irritation and sometimes coughing refluxes in the throat. And so you will typically try and avoid this by inducing with an agent and then getting your patient very stabilized, and then you can maintain it with isoflurane, oftentimes mixed with epinephrine. But this is a direct descendant of enflurane, and it's metabolized much, much less. So we're talking 0.2%. What did we see with enflurane? 5%, right? So they've significantly decreased the percent metabolism. It's very stable, commonly used, but it does have the ability to produce some trifluoroacetic acid, a small amount of fluoride ions, so you still have to worry a little bit about the toxicity, but it's relative to how much you're giving. If you only see 0.2% of the dose that's metabolized, it's pretty negligible now, the percent of toxicity that you would have happen with this one because of the very low metabolism you see with this one. Again, if you see the production of fluoride ions, which is actually starting to decline because of other agents like SIBO and Desflurane, which we haven't talked about yet, that are used much more frequently. It's still used, it's just used much less frequently. It's also very commonly used in veterinary medicine as an anesthetic there. All right, so Desflurane, we talked about how Desflurane is used a little bit less because of Des and SIBO chlorine. Desflurane is extremely common, and it's extremely commonly used. It does have the potential, though, for some tachycardia, which is what? Okay, so you might have some issues there. Depends on your patient, A. B, depends on your anesthesiologist getting it under control. But overall, it has a pretty favorable kinetic profile. Non-flammable, non-corrosive, these are all good things we want to see. It does also, like isoflurane, have that odor, so that means it has that irritating potential for the throat, and so you'll induce them and then maintain them on desflurane. Very, very common. You see more rapid recovery with desflurane than you will with isoflurane. That's another advantage to it. And the fluorine here is the only difference between isoflurane and desflurane. And adding this fluorine decreases the metabolism that you're going to see here. So that's an advantage with the development of this one. Let's see. When you compare it, though, to isoflurane, desflurane is going to be better. It's metabolized less than isoflurane, so 0.01%. What do we see with isoflurane? 0.2. We thought that was great, right? 0.01%. Okay, that's superior, far superior than isoflurane. So you don't have to worry as much about toxicity with this one. We like to say because of that we see no hepato or nephrotoxicities associated with it. It doesn't mean technically there's absolutely none because you still have the production of the degradation of 0.01%. So it's not technically an absolute, but 0.01 is pretty negligible. So that's why we get away with saying pretty much it's very, very safe. Rapid recovery, this is what we want to see with patients to decrease the post-op period and the cost. So this is another advantage. The metabolites you do see, though, with desflurane would be trichloroacetate. So what type of toxicity might this lead to? Hepatotoxicity, but it's relative to the amount of dose you're using. All right, sevoflurane is the other one that is very commonly used when we talk about how isoflurane is being less used. This one came out in 1990. This one's the newest one that we have available. We're in 2009, ready to go to 2010, but still, this is the newest one that we have available in this category. Non-flammable, non-irritating. The non-irritating part is the thing that sets it apart from desflurane, because you don't have that irritation that you did see with desflurane, but it is comparable and very similar in kinetic profile to desflurane. However, this one's going to have, it's going to sometimes slow the heart rate. And the other thing that's you got to be careful about sevoflurane is that seizures have been reported in patients, primarily children or very young adults. So what's your recommendation going to be because of that, or knowing that? You would just try and avoid the use in children and young adults. But overall, this one's pretty popular. It's potent, rapid induction and recovery, much less irritation to the mucous membranes than so with desflurane. Dose is different in different patients. Obviously, you have dose different in different patients with any drug. Sevoflurane undergoes significantly more metabolism than desflurane, though. Anywhere between 3% and 5% can be metabolized, so you will see a lot more metabolism with sevoflurane than you will with desflurane. But overall, it's pretty well tolerated. Some metabolites, these are what you're going to produce. So you're going to see a little bit more production of fluoride ions here. But relatively low nephrotoxicity when you consider the type of toxicity that you actually see. You would expect you would see more, but it has a pretty favorable kinetic profile. Not really associated with hepatotoxicity, so that's an advantage to sevoflurane. All right, so the incidence of hepatotoxicity or injured liver injury is going to be completely dependent on what? Right, first of all, how much gets metabolized, and secondly, what it actually gets metabolized into. Epoxy-fluorine, remember, we talked about how it's not clinically used, right? 70% of the dose is metabolized here. And this is the one, remember, that was very, very soluble, so it's going to take a long time to go into effect, and it's going to take a long time to wear off, and it's also associated with a lot of toxicities. You see a lot of fluoride ions generated, renal failure with this one. We don't want to kill our patients, but we still use this in animals, and we still use it to compare other anesthetics too. But overall, not used. All the newer anesthetics have better profiles. All right, so really, we don't have that many drugs, general anesthetics, that we typically use. Now, the reason we're talking about nitrous oxide is because, why? We already talked about this on Monday. Is nitrous oxide a general anesthetic? No. So why the heck are we talking about it? Right, we can mix it with a general anesthetic, and what advantage does that have? Lower the dose, and what is that correlated with? Fewer side effects, right. So nitrous oxide has a lot of advantage. The structurally, it's very, very stable, and it's pretty much associated with so little side effects that it's completely safe. Oftentimes, nitrous oxide can also be used as an anxiolytic to try and decrease anxiety. But really, there's no evidence of clear-cut metabolism. I guess the exception, though, would be if you're going to use this kind of product for, like, like a car enhancement. Has anybody ever seen that movie, Fast and the Furious, the group movies? They do what? Do they use nitrous oxide? What's the whole point? To make what? Their cars go faster, right? Well, you might think, well, how the heck does that work? Dr. Rancher just told me the structure is very stable, and right? So how the heck does it work? What's one of the biggest problems with people using nitrous, if you will, to try and increase the speed? You're like a race car driver. It's explosive, right? So the reason is because if you take this structure and you increase the temperature and the pressure very high, guess what happens to the structure, as of almost any structure? But more so with this one. Does it still stay stable? No, it starts to break down. And guess what you produce that makes it so flammable and explosive? Potentially. Raw oxygen, okay, because of the oxygen here. And the raw oxygen release is what makes it very dangerous. Now, in medicine, we don't have to worry about stuff like that, but this is the only other instance you'll usually hear nitrous being used. Very, very stable. Dentists use it a lot. Actually, dentists are using xylocaine way more than nitrous oxide, but we'll talk about that when we talk about the locus. All right. Alright, we already know what we do with this. Can you use nitrous oxide to fully anesthetize the patient?
No.
No, unless you're in a hyperbaric chamber. Alright, let's go back and look at the partition coefficients. We talked about blood to gas partition coefficients, and just to recap, what does blood to gas partition coefficients tell you anything? What might this data indicate?
Right.
Tells you the solubility of it. So higher the number, more soluble. See, methoxyfluorine 13, very high. So it's gonna. How does that affect induction and recovery? Right. It takes much longer. Okay, because it's longer to achieve saturation conditions. When you look at these agents and you look at the fat to gas partition coefficients, you notice something. What do you notice looking at this? Is there any sort of correlation? Okay, what do you see? Seems like these numbers. Well, what are the numbers increasing as we move down tell you? Let's start there. Okay, well, let's go back in one more step. Do you see more? Is it getting larger as you move down the table? Okay, so what's different that from like nitrous oxide versus methoxyfluorine relative to that? What do you think would affect the numbers increasing?
Is more distributing into the adipose tissue?
Absolutely. Why is more redistributing into the adipose tissue?
It's more lipophilic.
Because it's more lipophilic. So the more lipophilic molecules are, the faster you're going to get redistribution. How is that going to, or what kind of effect do you think that's going to have on duration?
Maybe longer acting?
No, it actually makes it shorter acting. Because if you get redistribution to the adipose tissue, do you get to the site of action to elicit its effect? You get more residual effects, though. The more you get redistribution to your adipose tissue, do you form kind of like a reservoir doing that? Yeah. So do you have a lot of blood flow going through your adipose tissue? No. So it can, over time, dissociate and release some into the blood. And so might you have residual effects because of that? Yeah. Do you understand that? Anybody confused? Does it make sense? Okay. So we always think about lipophilicity, redistribution, how it affects duration, etc. So that's one of the things you're going to see with lipophilic drugs. And you're going to see much more when we get talking about inducing agents in a minute. What do I want to say here? We haven't talked about all that stuff. Okay, let's talk about metabolism a little bit more. I know I taught you guys about metabolism. I want you to know the metabolism for anesthetics because why do you think I want to do that? Do I want to just torture you? No. Even though you think so. Oh, she's torturing me. No, but why is the metabolism of anesthetics so important? Right, it tells you the toxicity. So if knowing what it produces, is that going to help you explosively? If you can just take an anesthetic and know what it produces, is that going to help you as a clinician? No, right? Because what other important information do you need to know? How much it's metabolized. If you have something that's only 0.02 metabolized versus something that's 20% metabolized, you're pretty much thinking big deal about the 0.02% that's metabolized because it's negligible compared to something that's like 5, 10, 20% metabolized. You get the point? So not only is it important to know what you're producing, it's important for you to understand the degree of metabolism, right? Because it depends relative to the percent that is being metabolized. So, pretty much the two ways you'll generally see metabolism is through traditional dehydrohalogenation, so you can get hydroxylation alpha to your ether. Okay, that's very common. But the alcohol you're going to produce is going to be pretty unstable, so it's going to decompose, and that's how you generate your metabolites. What you can do to practice this is you could potentially take any of the structures I gave you, right, for your general anesthetics, which is not many, right, and you could just practice this. Question? Yeah, I mean, I could post it, but what I want to focus you to focus on is you don't memorize this. Like, this is not something you memorize. You just understand how they're metabolized, right? So what I want you to do is take your structures from your general anesthetics that we talked about and practice this. I'm telling you the two ways they're going to be metabolized, okay? So when you look at your ether derivatives, you look for what? What are we looking? We have an ether and it's the derivative analog. We're looking at what? Right, an alpha proton, okay, adjacent to our oxygen. So if you have that alpha proton, you get hydroxylation there. That alcohol intermediate, though, that you produce is your carbonylamine intermediate, which is unstable. So it easily breaks down to give you the production of your metabolite, okay? Very common, very straightforward. What if you don't have an ether derivative anesthetic, like halothane? What do you see happening very commonly with halothane? Dehydrohalogenation. We've talked about that last semester. The only other thing that you'll have happening in the degradation of anesthetics is sometimes that terminal carbon, if it has a free hydrogen there, could get hydroxylated to form your intermediate, and then it can break down. So that's how sometimes you also form fluoride ions that you wouldn't normally expect it would form, but that's how that's happening. Are we clear on how those are metabolized? Yes? No? Maybe so? Is it coming back? If you need help, come and see me. I can refresh your memory. But that's what I want you to know. And obviously, I would expect you to know whether something's an acetic acid derivative that you're producing, right? Versus if it's a fluoride ion and what kind of toxicity that would correlate with. Okay. Now we're going to transition ourselves to talking about inducing agents. Because why? Why do we have to talk about inducing agents? We use them commonly, but why? What, Jason?
We don't
want
to give too much.
Well, definitely. We don't want to give too much, but what else? Pardon? They have a very fast onset, yeah. So can you just give a general anesthetic alone? No, right? We talk about that. You have to induce your patient first, right? You have to put them under, right? They're counting the sheep, right? Jumping over the moon, right? One, two, okay, they're out, right? So you have to put your patient under first, then maintain them on a general anesthetic, okay? This is a mistake sometimes people make, and I'm thinking I don't understand why they make it. Like, I give you a case study, and you have to pick the drug or drugs that you're going to use for this patient under these certain circumstances, and they just pick a general anesthetic. Is that smart? No, right? How are you going to induce your patient, right? So we talk about inducing agents because we have to induce our patients. Oftentimes, as well, these inducing agents could be used for short-term procedures because if something's not going to take a long time and we already know they don't have a long duration, there's an advantage to just using this versus trying to go through the full gamut and give them a general anesthetic. All right, one of the most popular inducing agents is Versed. And has Dr. Blevstad talked to you guys about the benzodiazepines at all? Okay, so you know that looking at this, this is a benzo derivative, right? Did she talk about Versed at all? Okay, so you guys are pretty familiar with this one. Did she talk about the inducing effects of it? Not really? Okay. Well, at first I was thinking I didn't have to talk about it. All right, let's talk about it. So, Versed is a drug that came out in the mid-70s. Very potent, and it has lots of different effects. So, it causes skeletal muscle relaxation, it's a sedative, it's a hypnotic, depends on the dose that you're going to give. It also has anticonvulsant activity, so sometimes this could be used to get seizures under control. That's an off-label use for this one. An anxiolytic, you're not going to remember what's going on. These are all good things, okay? The good thing about this one is it's very fast-acting. You're going to see anywhere between 2 and 6 minutes for an onset. And it's short half-life, so you generally can only depend on it lasting between 45 and 60 minutes. So it's still in the short-acting category. Versed is also very commonly used as an anxiolytic prior to surgery, so AKA, for example. Let's say you have a cardiac patient going in for bypass surgery. Obviously, they're going to be a little nervous laying on the bed, right? Because they're going to be completely, it's one of the most invasive procedures, right? I mean, they're probably freaking out. I might not be in the land of the living in an hour, right? So the anxiety level is probably pretty high. Is that going to be a good thing for a surgeon wanting to go in and do the bypass surgery, having the patient freaking out? No, right? So oftentimes, Versed could be used and very commonly is used as an anxiolytic prior to surgery. It produces the drowsiness. It can produce loss of consciousness. We can use this as an inducing agent if we wanted to. It's just going to be dose dependent. It depends on if we want to use it. Let's see, if you look structurally, this imidazole up here is going to open whenever the pH gets less than 4. But ever, whenever we're in alkaline conditions above pH 4, which is that physiological pH, it's going to stay closed. And when it stays closed, it's more lipid soluble. So keeping it more lipid soluble is going to do what? What does it increase? Can it get across the nerve membranes faster? Yeah, so what does it increase? The onset, right? If this imidazole opened up at physiological pH, would it be as fast acting as it is? No, it wouldn't be nearly as fast acting. So that's mechanistically what goes on. Short-term insomnia, status seizures. Now, insomnia, actually, this is interesting. It can be used to produce short-term insomnia, which is beneficial for some types of procedures. And so, it's an advantage. Status seizures, this is an off-label use for it, so you wouldn't normally have people using this on their own, but for example, if you have somebody coming in and they have, it's hard, I haven't talked to you about epilepsy, yes, you're not going to know what I'm talking about. Let's say you're having repeated seizures, and it's kind of known as the word is status situation, but you have to get those under control. We have a few drugs that we can use to get them under control. And if you can't get it under control, like for example, those, or maybe there's deficiencies in those and you can't use those, you could use this one to try and get that under control because it is effective. So it's sometimes used. The biggest thing whenever you do give this drug, though, is you want to give it very slowly, okay? You don't want to just give your patient this very, very quickly. Because why? Why might you think? Different effect at different doses. Okay, but let's say you think you know what dose you want to give them, and you just give it to them really quickly. Well, we talked about how this drug has a very, what? Fast onset, okay? So what do you think could potentially happen to your patient if you don't slowly administer it? Quickly administer it. And let's say you might have been wrong, you could have been right. Respiratory arrest, okay? That's the reason. You're going to give this, okay? It's very commonly used, but we want to give it over very slow periods of time, okay? Another thing, though, I want to point out about this one is that it will cause birth defects, so you got to be careful what types of patients you're going to give it to. If you have, for example, a pregnant female, and she needs a procedure done, would you recommend using this? Absolutely not, okay? So that's another big red flag I want you to pay attention to. Metabolism is primarily through P450 metabolism, so make sure you avoid anything that's going to inhibit, like the P450 metabolism. Last semester, what's one of the big ones we talked about that will inhibit the P450 enzymes? And that's why pharmacists tell patients this, and I think I told you that to tell the patients why you tell them to avoid this. Does anybody remember? Rachel, you should remember, shouldn't you? Grapefruit juice, remember when we talked about that? How many people have ever heard their pharmacist say avoid taking grapefruit juice with this? And remember when I told you, tell people why. Why do I tell you to tell people why? Well, pretty much, but if you were told, don't do this, might you still do it and be like, yeah, they told me not to do that, but, like, it's an example, like when I taught you guys never take Tylenol when drinking alcohol, right, before or after. If I just said, don't ever take Tylenol when you're drinking, you might think, yeah, that crazy Dr. Bonner told me never to, but who cares, I'm still going to take it, right? But I went a step further to tell you why you don't take it, right? Because it can do what? Kill your liver, right? So the reason is if you tell people why not to do something, they'll remember it and they're more likely to not do it, right? So if you tell people, okay, don't take this with grapefruit juice, you want to tell them why, right? So you would want to avoid any sort of products like that, especially if you're going to undergo or about to undergo procedures that are going to involve your set. Because it would Very, very potent, fast onset, rarely used outside hospitals for obvious reasons, and you can use it for prolonged seizures, which we just talked about. It's actually very common to get those gas seizures under control, but be careful to use it very slowly. Don't use it for pregnancy females. Obviously, the degree of anesthetic is going to be completely dependent on the person. A, not everybody's going to respond to the same exact dose the same exact way. And the degree of consciousness is going to vary depending on person to person. And so sometimes people might have to have a little higher of a dose relative to somebody else. It's just completely dependent from person to person. The anesthesiologist evaluates the patient, figures out what the appropriate dose should be, but sometimes they have to tinker with it depending upon whether they've achieved stage three or not. All right, your intravenous anesthetics, we're going to talk about some of the other ones. Sodium salts of ultra short acting barbs. I know I haven't talked to you about barbs, but all I'm going to mention with these inducing agents is I'm going to show you the SAR for your barb derivatives. And because you guys might know this already from other classes, but in its heyday, there were a lot of barb derivatives that were synthesized, right? There were a lot of them that were used. But what's some of the problems with trying to give barb? You know what I mean by barb? Barbiturates, right? Anyway, what's the problem with them? Well, why the heck aren't we all just taking them then, if they're so safe? They're addicting, right? You have tolerance, dependence, withdrawal. Also, the biggest side effect is the sedative types of effects with them. And so, there are certain patients that will become addicted with them. Obviously, AKA, but one of the most famous people that became addicted to it is Elvis Presley, right? And you got to be really careful about what you're mixing with those. The only clinically used barbs, pretty much, that we're going to see in pharmacy are going to be the ones used to induce patients for inducing agents, and we're going to talk about a few that are used in epilepsy, okay? So those fall into the ultra-short-acting category or the long-acting category. You're not going to see short or intermediate category barbs being clinically used because those are the ones that, you know, the dependence issues, the withdrawal issues, the abuse potential primarily. So we're talking about using these to induce anesthesia intravenously, and they're not going to last longer than 30 minutes, okay? So we're only going to talk about two or three of them, and they're very lipophilic, and the difference between the barbs, let's look at the structure thiopental first. Usually with your barb derivatives, you have the basic structure. Usually you have an oxo here on the second position. This is the second position. This is the fifth position that's going to be substituted. But normally with most of your barb derivatives, you're going to see an oxo at the second position. That's why we call oxybarbs. None of the oxygen derivatives will be used as inducing agents. Instead, you're going to see sulfur here. That transforms it into what we call a biobarb. And what's the rationale for it? What's the difference between oxygen versus sulfur? Sulfur is more lipophilic, and is that something we want for a good inducing agent? Do we want more lipophilicity? Yeah. So the sulfur, the thiobarbs, are what we're going to see with our inducing agents. Okay. Ketamine, we briefly talked about this, but ketamine is more of a dissociative agent. We don't really get true unconsciousness with ketamine, and clinically speaking, we rarely see ketamine being used clinically. There are some exceptions to when we would use this clinically, but we would never use it for like inducing anesthesia or anything like that. Ketamine is very dangerous, and most of the time you see a lot of abuse potential with this one because of the dissociative effects. That's one of the reasons it's locked up. It's used commonly in veterinary medicine. And why do you think people might want to get their hands on ketamine? Not everybody, those freaks out there, right? Why would they want this? That's why you got to be careful when you go out, right? So Well, why? Pardon?
It's a good high.
It's a good what? High? No, not necessarily. It's not going to give them like more of a high. People steal this drug because it's used as a date rape drug, so they can give it to people, put it in their drinks, stuff like that. So we're not going to really talk a lot about this besides that point. It's not a true anesthetic or inducing agent for that. It doesn't have the same profile. What we're going to spend a lot of time talking about is our BARB derivatives. So they're all going to have this basic structure. Notice there's two positions that are pretty much going to change on the BARBs, the second position and the fifth position. So in the second position with your inducing agents, they're all going to be thio BARBs. And then in the fifth position is where you're going to see your alkyl group substitution, And this is a very, very old drug. This came out in the early 30s, okay? It's very ultra-short acting and widely used. It's very, very cheap. The biggest side effects to inducing a patient with BARBs are going to be the residual sedative effects. And why would we see a lot of sedative effects using this kind of a product? Well, what did we say a little while back about our inducing agents? When we looked at the back to gas partition coefficients, we talked about, we see more because they are more. Right, you get redistribution, right, to the adipose tissue. So you get residual effects over longer periods of time. So you're going to have residual sedative effects using your BARB derivative. Now, it might not be a big deal, right? If it's not an outpatient procedure and, you know, your patient's going to need to be sedated after the procedure for a while, it might not be a big deal at all. You might be like, yeah, I don't care if they're sedated. I don't care if they have residual effects because we need them to be sedated after the procedure. But if you need your patient to kind of be alert and wake up quickly, you might want to avoid something like this because of the residual sedative effects that are going to go on. Extremely fast onset, though. And a lot of protein binding because of the lipophilicity with this one, exclusively used as an inducing agent. Okay? All right. Metabolism-wise, this one can get oxidized. It could actually be metabolized into pentobarbital, which is an active metabolite that can actually have completely different effects than the sedative-inducing effects to it. So sometimes you have to worry about metabolism with this one. It can get hydroxylated, conjugated, excreted, but oftentimes because of the lipophilicity, before most of the dose has a chance of getting metabolized and conjugated and then excreted, it gets redistributed, so that's the reason for the sedative effects. All right, thiamolol is very, very similar to thiopental. The only difference is the degree of unsaturation here. And thiamolol is extremely commonly used. It's very, very potent. It's 2 to 3 times more potent than thiopental, and it's cheaper than thiopental. So all very good things. Again, used as an inducing agent. All right, so let's say you want to use drugs that don't cause as much sedative effects, right? Well, for inducing agents, we've only talked about potentially using Merced, thiopental, and thiamolol. Okay, well, let's say a BARB derivative is not, or a benzodiazepine is not in the cards, so you don't want to use those. Propofol, okay? You've heard propofol used or talked about so commonly in the news because of who? Michael Jackson, right? What a complete moron to give anybody propofol to try and induce them into or use kind of for insomnia or get them to sleep. Complete moron. He should have never got his medical license, ever. And you would never, ever give this to anybody outside a hospital setting, okay? So no wonder he died. And it's unfortunate that, obviously the physician was so stupid and maybe trying to use the money to give it to a patient. Not really ethical. Propofol is only used as an inducing agent, okay, to induce anesthesia. It's actually a pretty old drug. It's about 14, 15, 16 years old. And it pretty much has replaced thiopental as the drug for choice. The reason why, if you're thinking, well, if it's so commonly used and it's such a great drug, why did it not replace thiopental years ago? It was 14 years old. What's your reason for probably why? Well, the same can be, what have I taught you so far? Migraines, right? So the same could be said for why Hemotrex is being used so much.
The cost,
right? So if it's on patent, if it still has the patent or holds the patent, the cost is going to be much more. So they used to use the barbiturate of this much more. Propofol is off patent now, so it's very, very cheap. And so it's very commonly used, and it has replaced the use for your barb derivatives. It doesn't mean that the barbs aren't still used as inducing agents. It's just propofol is so commonly chosen. Rapid induction, less than 30 seconds. This is incredible. This is great. And it produces unconsciousness, 4 to 8 minute duration. So you got to be set up and ready to go, because you do not have a long time with this one. So you got to continually give it. Hypotension is one of the big side effects with this one. So, for example, you have to be careful if somebody is in a trauma situation or bleeding traumatically, because do you want to exacerbate any sort of hypotension? No. So there are certain instances where you would want to avoid this, especially pay attention to the hypotension issue for this one, because it does cause hypotension. When you give it to somebody, it could cause some pain at the injection site. Sometimes you'll see a local being used to try and decrease that. But it's rapidly and extensively metabolized because it's so lipophilic. And it's very useful for very brief procedures. You do not get as much sedative effects, nearly as much sedative effects as you would if it was a barb derivative. But be very careful if, like, you have somebody that has a GI bleed or a trauma patient, their blood pressure is already going to be low. You're not going to want to choose this one because of the hypotension situations. But for procedures that last less than an hour, this might be a good one to choose, because in the post-op period, your patient's going to come out of it much faster, and they're going to be more alert, awake, less groggy, etc. You don't see a lot of nausea and vomiting that's associated with propofol, so you don't even have to really use antiemetics with this one. Now, what if you do have somebody that has hypotension issues and you can't use an inducing agent that causes hypotension? We have Amidate, also very commonly used, and this now can be used in those types of situations. You do not see nearly the decrease in blood pressure that you would see using propofol. This one's used a lot with outpatient procedures, and it gives you very prompt awakening. So less than 30-second induction, 3 to 5 minute duration, pretty comparable to propofol. You still see some pain potentially during injection. You could potentially get away around this by injecting a little local, but it's not huge pain. So tell your patient to pretty much suck it up, right? All right.